Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. This is Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On Connect the Dots every week, I connect the dots between your personal health and our total health environment. I'm a long-standing health, food, and environmental journalist reporting on Alternet, The Huffington Post, Intent.com, and other venues. Every week on Connect the Dots, I speak with different thought leaders, activists, authors, scientists, and social critics and a whole range of people so that we can look beyond our immediate health to all of the things in our environment that determine our health, the health of our communities, our society, the health of the basics that we need for life, food, water, air, earth, as well as the health of the earth itself, the whole living being and context in which we live. And every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss different facets of that. Have a really great show, a very exciting show for you today. Very thrilled about it. We've had a number of programs on GMOs in the past, and we'll continue to have them, you know, as long as that's needed for people to become informed and become active. In fact, probably not hearable in archives, but for those of you who tuned in a little early to today's show, there was a wonderful talk, a brief kind of 2 or 3 minute chat by Jim Hightower on what the problems are with genetically engineered foods, and a call to action, which I will amend, because his completely timely and accurate statement was recorded before the vote in California on the right to know, and right now this show is coming in right before the vote in Washington State on 522 to label GMOs. So I want to second that. We'll discuss that more in the show. But today we're going to look through a broader lens at GMOs internationally. You know, we tend to think about, is it on, you know, we're trying to get it on the label and to know if it's in our food supply or in foods that we choose to eat, and that we have a citizen right to do that, and that's what's going on here, and that's the, you know, the goal here in the U.S. of many that are concerned about these foods and how they contaminate the food supply and have unstudied and unknown health risks, as well as agricultural risks, energy costs, and ecological problems in their cultivation. But today we're going to broaden the lens and look at GMOs internationally, because the multinational companies that are pushing these products and developing them are not just stopping, you know, at food ingredients that we may or may not have here in the U.S. In many European countries, those kinds of foods have been banned, but in some places, the drive for GMOs is really invading other countries and really threatening true sources of planetary wealth. Now, I say this as we are still in the middle of the shutdown, meltdown, breakdown in the American government over, you know, picking up the tab for health care, for the health problems and the health costs that we incur through failing to properly vet the destructive effect of a number of industrial and agricultural products and ways of doing business that, though highly profitable, also impact health and are really not accountable for or studied for those impacts. And so right now this has driven the American health care tab up rather high. It also could be mitigated by integrative health options if we could access them, but that's an issue and that's not happening. So we're almost at a point of shutdown, hopefully, which will be mitigated and stopped all around health and the wealth that we spend or incur through failure to consider health on individual, community, and planetary levels. So today on Connect the Dots and looking at GMOs, we're going to be looking at the real wealth, the planetary wealth, and the threats that GMO agriculture poses to planetary wealth. And by planetary wealth, we are going to talk today about the biodiverse and endangered rainforests in Brazil with Alana Leia, who has been an incredible leader, pioneer, and advocate for protecting and restoring and making sustainable initiatives that will continue to protect and restore the most biodiverse and endangered rainforests on the planet. And so I'm so pleased to welcome her today to talk about her efforts. She has an amazing background and an amazing cultural background that led her to this unique and much-needed path. We'll learn more about that too today. Welcome, Alana Lea, to Connect the Dots.
Oh, thank you so much, Allison. Can you hear me clearly?
Very clearly. Very
wonderful.
Clearly.
Wonderful.
And so you have founded two amazing organizations. We'll be talking about them a lot throughout the program. And you're also the author of a book, Trees of Transformation, and you blog on Care 2, Elephant Journal, and the Huffington Post. And you're somebody who travels internationally and really is, we talk global. Many of us speak global, you know, from where we are positioned in our world, in our society, in our own country, in our town, in our rural area, wherever we are. But you're someone who really travels the world to kind of bring these various strands together, and you've spent a great deal of time in Brazil. Tell our listeners what need prompted you to launch Rainforest Eco?
Well, I was born in Brazil, and a number of years ago when circumstances just became extremely difficult for me in the U.S., I decided to go back to Brazil to refresh my spirit and my being in the nature and learn more about the place where I was born. Now, my entire life, I had worked with the plant kingdom in various horticultural endeavors. And I had illustrated a book on the healing plants of the Amazon rainforest for a company a few years before that. So I really felt that I would find my own renewal in the rainforest where I was born, thinking I would offer whatever skills and experiences I had gained in my North American life, because we left the United States when I was a baby, or we left Brazil when I was a baby to live in the U.S., to see if I could use my experience for rainforest conservation or renewal. And when I arrived there, thinking I would be going to the Amazon, I was told by people, you were born here in the most diverse and endangered rainforest on the planet. Stay here and help us. So then I was taken into the countryside and given a real download of information about how the rainforest was degraded and taken down in the first place, which was primarily for coffee, which was then replaced by cattle. And that took me into relationships that have grown into business and nonprofit activities to restore that very rainforest. And in the course of these trips, I've been back four times in the last 5 years, I've been working primarily within small rural communities in between the cities of Sao Paulo and Rio, where a lot of the agricultural food production is done. And so there's a very close relationship there between food and forest, because forest was taken down for agriculture, and in the Atlantic rainforest, it was taken down for coffee. Now, up north in the Amazon in Brazil, it's being taken down primarily for GMO, soy, and corn.
Okay, so let's talk about this. You're saying that the rainforest, the most source, you know, one of the major planetary sources of biodiversity, its trees, its plants, all of the biodiverse habitat, as well as the living species of all natures that reside there and are part of that ecosystem, that this is being felled in order to plant GMO food crops for the United States and elsewhere? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the crops are being exported all over the world, not mm-hmm. just to the United States. Mm-hmm. So this is a whole area that is not my expertise. I'm far more acquainted with what's happening in the Atlantic rainforest. However, mm-hmm. there have been discoveries of horrific events occurring in the Brazilian Amazon as recently as the last few years, where Agent Orange was sprayed on the Amazon for deforestation under the radar without any smoke to be detected. Mm-hmm. And these things have been written about, and I discovered them through intensive questioning on Google and mm-hmm. found that things were even written up in Brazilian newspapers, and they were being written up in European newspapers. It's just that we weren't getting wind of it here. Mm-hmm. So the things that occur in the Amazon are not what I would like to focus on today. I can share mm-hmm. a little bit through the I wrote a blog post for Huffington a couple of years ago for Climate Day, and if you were to Google my name, Alana Leah, L-E-A, last name, with Huffington Post, you would come up with that, where I gave what I had discovered up to that point about what's mm-hmm. going on in the Amazon. Mm-hmm. But I would rather focus on the experiences that I've observed and had in the Atlantic rainforest, where mm-hmm. it is a different story. It's a different dynamic because the rainforest is already 93% gone. Mm-hmm. And the 7% remaining holds the most biodiversity of any place on the planet. Mm. And in that biodiverse area, Monsanto has set up shop through a partnering U.S. NGO that is doing some really incredible work there that really, you know, frightens and saddens me. And I do my best to stay in a useful manner about it by sharing the question with you. You know, go to Google and ask your own question. Who is Monsanto's nonprofit partner in Brazil? And dive in and educate yourself.
What are they actually, what are they doing there that, you know, describe for our listeners a little of what they're doing?
Okay. Well, in a region farther north than where I work, in the area of Bahia, where there is more intact rainforest and more biodiversity, they are hiring local people to harvest native seed. The native seed is then mixed with genetically modified crop seed and spread using agricultural equipment in a new method of reforestation that they're mm-hmm. very pleased about. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is, they have a name for this new seed mixture. It's called Muvaca. And this, I'm not sure how many years this practice has been taking place, but one of my great concerns is that one of the characteristics of genetically modified seed is that it can withstand a great deal of herbicide. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering what kinds of trees of our native species trees of this incredible wealth of biodiversity are going to be able to survive these applications of herbicide. Mm-hmm. And then does that yield then yet another type of tree that is of interest and value to them? So, you know, I just have extreme concern about this experiment that's taking place, and that local people, by and large, don't have a great deal of education and are in need of money. So when an entity comes along and offers them money, funding, mm-hmm. they tend to take it mm-hmm. and not have a huge view of what the future repercussions of this activity are going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are the future repercussions that they would, you know, should be and we should be concerned about?
Well, the things, speaking from what I've observed down south where I work and in the state of Sao Paulo primarily and also a little bit in the state of Rio, the things that have occurred there through these same types of partnerships, similar arrangements, are a great toxification of the water and the land, as well as the animals and the humans. because mm-hmm. of the use of the herbicides, primarily Roundup, and the fertilizers that are being used on the crops. So in these areas, the genetically modified seed is very prevalent for food crops that are feeding the cities of Rio and Sao Paulo. And even though we hear that they have a transgenic labeling system operative there, the application and enforcement of that system is not very good at all. It's very hard to find labeled food there. Mm-hmm. And so what I've observed in these agricultural growing areas are young people in their flip-flops and shorts applying herbicides and pesticides to crops completely unprotected. There's, you know, no telling what the amounts are, you know, that are going in. You know, there's no proper sense of measurement or application, much less protection. So this is going into the food, it's going into the earth, it's going into the water. And then people are having experiences in both these agricultural areas and in the areas that are adjacent to the genetically modified forests that are, you know, coming out of similar partnerships. Mm-hmm. They're having deformities of animals and miscarriages and cancers and all sorts of health problems that are arising. And so it's, and nobody's really pinned down yet, is this coming because of the consumption of the genetically modified foods? Is this coming more from the applications of the herbicide? It's just that there is this enormous toxicity that has emerged in paradise. I mean, it's just so incredibly sad to witness paradise being poisoned.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That's terrible. I mean, the earth itself is a paradise, and this region that, you know, you are loving and protecting and visiting and caring for through your work and your advocacy is really at the heart of the planetary activity and diversity. Can you explain, just to back up for some of our listeners, can you explain the role of biodiversity? It may sound like a kind of obvious question for people who are familiar with it, but I know that to some of us, you know, growing up in urban environments or not well schooled in ecological systems, you know, it's just kind of it's a phrase, and we don't, you know, I think it needs a little unpacking, Alana.
Sure.
If you
sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's just this immense interrelationship of life forms that include but are not limited to the things that I'm going to name. So, for example, the numbers of different types of fruit, you know, just untold numbers of types of fruit of which we've only sampled a very, very small number. And these are fruits that are now being labeled as superfruits and being sold as superfoods because they're so high in vitamins and minerals that our bodies need. And they've only discovered and, you know, exported a very small number of these. So we're talking about fruit, we're talking about types of flowers that are just exotically beautiful, for example, for orchid lovers, or just the types of blooms on trees that attract the different types of insects and birds and butterflies that drop berries that feed the wildlife. So it's the teeming masses of life, from the smallest insects to the things that are the organisms that are breaking down the leaf matter in the forest soil, to the things that are feeding the undergrowth. There's a lush undergrowth of herbs and bushes and shrubs that, again, everything is containing different types of nutrients and food values that we barely scratch the surface of. That's where most of our pharmaceuticals are being derived from, the very small number of discoveries that have yet been made from this area. So whether it's wild animal life or incredible butterflies or fruits or flowers, much less trees themselves and all their exotic woods and characteristics that they bring us. It's this just teeming diversity that's beyond imagination, that's beyond belief, that is what this little 7% remaining pocket of rainforest holds. And it holds more of this type of diversity in the Atlantic forest than it does even in the Amazon, because the Atlantic forest is right near the Atlantic Ocean. Mm-hmm. So that brings in a whole different kind of climate and cooling coming in from the ocean that allows for a greater amount of diversity than the heat of the Amazon does.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, this biodiversity, which you describe so eloquently right in that location and what that, you know, what that looks like and how that's functioning and interacting, if that is diminished, if this last pocket, which you speak of, is further diminished, it's kind of like, what are the effects? I mean, on the one hand, I can imagine, for example, it's like going into, you know, the holy of holy secret manuscript room in, you know, the oldest world library where ancient texts and knowledge are, you know, kind of in their crumbling old manuscript form protected, and wiping out that knowledge and information. That would be, you know, on an information level. But this is also information. You know, what happens to the rest of the planet when a biodiverse region is diminished or wiped out? What are the planetary-wide effects?
Well, that's the part that I don't even dare to imagine. I share so much your sense, that preciousness, that's exactly what this is. It's an information and a knowledge repository of which we barely even scratch the surface. And I cannot foresee a future where we don't have that. That's where my passion and devotion is fueled into somehow saving that in integrity without tampering with it, without changing it before we even know what it is. I find it too horrible of an outcome to give the power of my word or my energy to describe. You know, it's, to me, it's like living after a nuclear holocaust, to have lost that much life intelligence on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. So rather than going farther down that road, I would rather switch the energetic conversation into how can we preserve and protect and renew what has been lost, because we can share this sense of its ferocious sacredness and its importance to all of life in ways that we haven't yet comprehended.
Mm-hmm. So let's shift. I agree with you. And let's talk. I think this is the perfect time to talk about the two initiatives that you have launched down there, to tell us what they're about and what they're doing and how people listening might want to support that. So tell us about your two initiatives.
Great. Thank you. Okay. This is such a small scale. It's a humble offering that I pray will grow through time into being a much larger offering, that began by my reaching out as a horticulturist in these rural areas and asking questions and saying, what do you need? You know, what would help you to preserve what you have? So here I'm talking about now that not in the area where there's the 7% remaining. I work primarily in the area where it's the 93% gone. So in those areas, further deforestation is not legal. there is encouragement for reforestation, and unfortunately a great deal of the reforestation that's occurring is happening, is called, sustainable forest mosaics. Google that one. And you'll find they're genetically engineered eucalyptus forests that are being interplanted with the native forests. So as I've learned about these challenges in these areas, I created these projects to support local native seed collectors who are selling to local organic tree nurseries. And I buy trees, I crowdfund the purchase of trees through the website igivetrees.com. Mm-hmm. And I buy trees from local nurseries that represent over 100 species of the native trees of the area. And then we give them to a small local Brazilian nonprofit in the region who gives them to subsistence farm families who are wanting to restore the forest on their land. So the beauty of it is it's coming rather than from one big corporate funder. It's coming from a diversity of people, from school children to church groups to people on the internet and Facebook, who are making small contributions that are then being funneled through to keep these small individual nurseries in business, the small nonprofit, and this whole community of people feeling, rather than isolated and hopeless and overwhelmed, feeling supported by a network of people. And when I go back to Brazil, I pull out my iPad and I show them pictures of people and say, look, you know, these are the people who gave you the trees. And then when I'm here and I do any public speaking, I'm showing people pictures of, look, these are the people who you gave the trees to. So I'm sort of this go-between to create this grassroots movement to replenish the forest and do it in a really healthy, loving way to support the people there to support themselves, knowing that we receive the benefit of their banking. You know, I look at it as an eco-bank, that they're restoring this forest for the benefit of all of us and for our children and future generations. And so,
and that's igivetrees.com.
That's igivetrees.com, yeah.
And people can participate. Anyone listening to this show could be part of that. So it is really wonderful to think about giving wealth, sharing, and support in this beautiful way, you know, in terms of what people can do. That's fantastic. Thank you. It's a really great project.
And, yeah, I love it.
What is your second project? We only have about 2 minutes, so let's just kind of briefly touch on that for people listening to this half of the show, and we can talk about it more after the break. But, you know, what is your second project?
The second project is a nonprofit project called Ecofloresta, where we have a seed bank. We're beginning a seed bank so that working with these same communities, we're really encouraging people to not only sustainably harvest, but also save some seed for the future and know how precious it is, work with the nonprofits doing the educational work there so that people start to understand that it's a treasure. Don't give it away easily. Preserve it for the future generations, and also support the education and the maintenance of the trees. After we give these trees away, we need to make sure that they're organically maintained and over the course of the years. So that's what the nonprofit project really feeds, is education, seed banking, and tree maintenance.
So, and actually that touches on an interesting point. We had a question from somebody, and this touches right on what you're saying here, which is also one of the ways this whole unfortunate thing unfolded, and we'll go into that more in the second half of the show, is because the local people are not aware of the dangers. They sold land in the past, because allow this not that they could have that easily stopped it either, but because of, you know, the need for money, and unlike here in the U.S. where there's internet everywhere and a lot of educational opportunity if we can find the time to avail ourselves of it, there's need of more education and not the same plethora of tools and resources. So this project also has an important component both of saving this true planetary wealth, the seeds, the rainforests, the biodiversity, but also of educating the people in the region to what they have and to being caretakers. And I think that makes it really unique. So we'll talk more about this in the second half of our program. We're coming into the break for station identification. Please stay with us, listeners, for the second half of Connect the Dots with Alana Leia talking about GMOs in Brazil and internationally. We'll talk a little bit more about what's upcoming in the U.S. Stay with us for the second half of the show. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots for the second half of our show. I'm Allison Rose Levy, health, green, and food journalist on Alternet, Huffington, and healthjournalist.com. We're talking today with Alana Leia, who's launched two fantastic initiatives in Brazil, ecofloresta.org and igivetrees.com, which allow the local people to restore and preserve and maintain organically key areas of biodiversity in the Brazilian rainforest. And we're talking about the incursion of GMOs, what is being done to address harm that was already done, and what you can do to participate. So welcome back, Alana, to the second half of the show. I just want to say to listeners, if you're just tuning in, please do go and check for the first half of the show in our archives, like us on iTunes. You can now listen to the show on your phone as well, and pass along the links to friends who may be interested in this topic and this very important work. So, you know, let's talk a little bit. It's kind of an amazing thing. You mentioned in the last half of the show that one of the things that you're also doing is helping the local people preserve, build, save seeds, plant again, and maintain the plantings organically. It's kind of ironic that you know, people have to now go into these traditional areas to educate the people into what organic maintenance, which their ancestors no doubt had kind of done or allowed for centuries, entails. That's kind of an interesting thing. I bet they teach you a few things to do as well. Any stories about that?
Well, yeah, and I don't want to give the idea that I'm teaching them anything, because
okay.
Really I'm just supporting the people mm-hmm. who know how to do it to do it more. So mm-hmm. there are certainly plenty of people there who remember how weeds were controlled before Roundup existed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the chemical companies have such strong influence there, and they also fund environmental education, and they go into the farmer rural associations, and they teach people that this is the way it must be done. If you want to keep up with the rest of the world, this is the way it must be done. And they believe that because it's coming across with some authority. So I'm presenting the counterbalance by going in and just finding who are the people who remember and know the right way to do things in harmony with nature, mm-hmm. and support them to stay strong in their beliefs, to share what they know, and to give them the credibility of this gringa who periodically arrives. You know, it's like, there I'm the American, I'm the gringa, and it's like, oh, she must know something. And so what I tell them that I know is, you're doing a good thing here. That is brilliant, the way you're pulling that grass back. You know, and sometimes they tell me to tell the school children who have helped to fund the trees that we've just given them, you tell those children this is a lot of work. It would be a lot easier if we could pour the chemicals on this. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, the children are so happy and so proud of you that you are wise and strong enough to do it this way. This is so much better for their earth.
How did these companies, Monsanto and these other companies, get a foothold in this area? How did it come about that they had moved in here and are able to exert such authority and, you know, welcomed in? What happened there?
Well, I can't tell you what happened day one. I haven't tracked it far enough back to say, in the beginning, this is how it first happened. Mm-hmm. What I can tell you about is what I know from, you know, the recent decade, say. Mm-hmm. So they created partnerships with big international U.S.-based NGOs, two of them in particular, who I don't want to name, but you can easily find by putting into Google Dow Chemical Nonprofit Partner and Monsanto Nonprofit Partner. So, you know, doing that bit of research for yourself, you will discover who these partners are, who carry an immense amount of credibility as being good guys. Mm-hmm. And so the combination of partnership with these good guys and their money funding the good guys went, or, you know, the so-called good guys, made partnerships and arrangements with the government that makes everything look like it's going to be good for everybody. But it's when you get down to the fine points of what's actually happening in these areas where they're working, that's where everything goes haywire. And then you learn that the local people are not being well paid, or they're being kept off their land, or they're, you know, being taught to use, I mean, they fund the environmental education there. So people believe hook, line, and sinker that this is the modern way to do things, whether it's grow your crops or kill your weeds. If they want to keep up with the rest of the world, this is what they're going to have to do. And that's how it happened. So there's been no one or organization supporting the small people to tell them that your ancestors did it the right way. And they're poor, and they just need money. So even these days, there are people who will come in and they'll offer a small landholder money to plant a genetically modified or genetically engineered forest on their land that take the heavy applications of herbicide and then poison their water supplies. And the people just think, I need the money, I'm going to do this. And this is happening a lot in our area. This is what we're kind of trying to compete against, you know, through our crowdfunding.
Yes, I get it. So, I mean, of course, it's the same story everywhere and on many different issues. I've covered fracking a great deal. It's the same thing. People lease their lands. They need the money. They don't think about what it's doing to their water, their food, the value of their land, their neighborhood, water downstream in major cities, all the rest of it, because of this short-term need and pressure. I understand your hesitance to name names, and you know, people can Google, as you state, but it's a rather baffling question just to look at the larger social context for this, that you're saying a non-governmental organization, this could be a large environmental group. You know, I guess what, you know, on the one hand, you have these large groups that people turn to, support, you know, hope and believe are representing the kinds of interests that you are. But in fact, I guess they build big administrative offices, they develop partnerships, they have to fundraise. And so they wind up, in some cases, as you're mentioning, making these kinds of compromises, very serious compromises, actually, that kind of give the whole game away. And then it has to sort of start and seed up from the grassroots again, as you were doing. Have any of these companies acknowledged, you know, what they may be doing wrong or what have done in the past and tried to make amends, you know, or not?
Not that I am aware of. And the way this whole thing came to light for me in the first place, because I was a believer in these organizational good guys when I first arrived there, and in fact went and approached one of them trying to bring them in to the area where I was working, saying, look, I just bought trees from these growers and they're doing this great thing. And it was a local person who had worked in the nonprofit arena all over South America for many years, who heard of my effort, and she said, stop right now. Do not bring them here. Let me speak with these people first. And it was after her conversation with them that all of a sudden nobody wanted to talk to me anymore, and I was just going, what just happened? And then I started to unravel the mystery in the story, and I just learned that there are those who know and there are those who don't know. There are those who are more comfortable because they receive money and funding through these alliances, and there are those who are afraid and actually get, you know, death threats for speaking up against. So it becomes this really convoluted, frightening scenario to get involved with, and that's where I just stood back and went, whoa. Is the only thing I want to do here is support the people who are doing a good thing and just reinforce them completely that they're on the right track. Don't give up. You know, like one of the nurseries, I've only been able to buy trees from one small nursery rather than the 17. My big goal, here's my dream, folks. We can reforest 250 acres with 170,000 trees that are sitting in those nurseries and help keep people in business, you know, just help keep this whole area thriving. And we could conceivably do that much every year, supporting this organic network to thrive and feel like they have a leg to stand on and not give way to these powers that be around them. So, you know, I guess I just don't believe in the good guys the way I once did. I can't call them the good guys anymore, and I know that they know what they're doing. You know, I don't think they're blind to what's going on. I think they've just got different priorities and really good advertising.
Cultural or environmental organizations or both?
Environmental. These are environmental organizations.
And do you ever feel concerns for your own personal safety in, you know, moving around in a country in which you do have a cultural family background and heritage, but still, you know, given the forces that you're dealing with, I know, you know, you're working at a very grassroots level, and likely in their minds that's a small thing and they might leave you alone, but have you ever felt concerns about that? Because it sounds like there's a lot at stake for these big players.
Do
you want to share a little
bit about
that?
Well, I have felt that. And there are times when I'm there, when I'm in fairly remote areas by myself and I'm with my camera, and I have felt just in my body, I have felt, this is not a good idea, this is not safe, go to your room immediately, kind of thing. And just really hold up and examined, you know, was that a real fear, was that not a real fear? It's hard to know, but I know that two of the women who I have learned a great deal from, who were very outspoken environmental activists, have both had death threats numerous times and warned me to be really careful. So I just thought, you know what? I did not come here to be a martyr. I came here to do this good thing for my children, for the children of the earth, and not to put myself in a situation of danger, which is also what causes me to back down from naming organizations and just say, hey, let's do this good thing with the small people because we can. How about that?
Is there any support from the Brazilian government for, your or any other of these initiatives, or, you know, what is their role in all of this?
Well, the government has made the partnerships with the chemical companies and these big entities on the state level. Dow Chemical, with their nonprofit partner, tied up all the contracts with the state of Sao Paulo for the reforestation along the waterways of the biggest water system on the planet. And this is all being done with chemically grown trees, that with herbicides being applied. So, you know, it's just like they all jumped into bed together. And learning about Brazilian government and politics is very complicated. You know, here in midlife, I'm learning about how things work there, and I don't even want to go down that road. It's, again, just a matter of not leaving it to government to act in our best interests, no matter where we are. That's the way I believe right now. Mm-hmm. And we can always hope that they will, but in the event that they're not doing what we feel they ought to be doing that protects our rights, our freedoms, our land, our basic needs, we must do it for ourselves and each other. And when we meet somebody who's doing something in a good way that needs help, let's just say, how can I lend a hand? And be there for each other and not leave it to governments to do these things for us, while we pay attention and do our best as citizens to make these things shift and change into something more equitable, not wait for them to change on that level before we do something ourselves.
So people can help from here if they care and are interested in these initiatives, thanks to the internet. This kind of thing really, you know, can be, participation can be from anywhere in the world to these important regions. So listeners, you can go to www.ecofloresta.org, and that, I'll spell that, it's ecofloresta.org, and you can also go to igivetrees.com to support the work of Alana Lea, the terrific work that you are doing ongoing. Let's just take a little bit of a shift here, pivot, as John Nichols likes to say, to an interrelated topic, because as it happens, in addition to your connection to Brazil, you're also American, and I know have been recently in Washington State, where we have an important GMO labeling initiative on the ballot. It's called Number 522, and it's going to be on the ballot, and it will be people in Washington State can vote in just a few weeks' time and become the first state in the United States to label GMOs. Tell us a little bit your perceptions and views on that. I know you're participating in an upcoming GMO event, and also what you're seeing on the ground in Washington State.
Okay. Well, right now I'm on the Olympic Peninsula, where there are a lot of very conscious growers and consumers of organic produce. So in this area, it just seems so commonly widely known that GMO labeling is important that I'm not concerned what's happening here. I'll be in Seattle in a few days and I'll find out what the mindset is there. What I'm generally getting through the rumble of the people who I know is that it's a great topic of conversation. People are having conversations they never had before. There's so much awareness because of what happened in California last year, and people here are motivated to want to be that first state that does the labeling. So I'm feeling very optimistic, and I don't watch television a great deal, but the little bit that I do watch, I've been seeing some very good advertising that's being put out by both, or it's showing rural communities, growers speaking for themselves, saying they don't want to have more GMOs. They want to really preserve the integrity of their crops, and they're in favor of the labeling. and a lot of mothers and women speaking about the food that they're feeding their children, and they're really supportive of the labeling. So I'm generally getting the tone of optimism and support for I-522.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's great. I just want to also mention to listeners that, you know, we're accustomed to thinking locally, and that's important, and then also thinking globally, but it's also good to think across our whole society. So wherever you are in the United States, if you support GMO labeling, this is a turnkey leverage point. It's not, of course, it's just the voters of Washington State who will make this important decision, but you can also support those efforts and help those educating people about that, withstand, you know, the last-minute corporate-sponsored ads and misinformation, which, you know, had a very harmful effect in California, and which it would, you know, it's easily anticipated will be coming hot and heavy as the final weeks approach. You can help people in Washington continue that educational process anywhere you are in the country by supporting Food Democracy Now online at Food Democracy Now. Now.org, who is, you know, really conducting a great deal in that campaign. And you can keep the educational process up and defend against deceptive advertising by doing that anywhere that you are, because, you know, the thing about a leverage point is if you turn the key on the leverage, everything afterward becomes a lot easier, and that's something that people who care about protecting our food supply, you know, can participate in from anywhere. And if you want more specific information about GMOs in the food supply, please do check the Connect the Dots archive. I've had many, many of the thought leaders in this area, from John Robbins to Dave Murphy and Lisa Stokey at Food Democracy Now. A whole host of other people have been on the show. You can find more specific information there. And I know also, Alana, that you're participating in an upcoming informational event. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about that in case they'd like to learn more there?
Sure. I've actually put a page up on my website. If you go to igivetrees.com/GMO, it gives an overview of this upcoming summit. It's a mini summit with John Robbins and Jeffrey Smith and a number of other speakers from a wide spectrum of perspectives who will be speaking on the GMO issue from October 25th through 27th. And can access it for free on the internet, so you'll find the link there on my website. And what I like about it is I'm going to be learning so much. The little bit that I've been exposed to from watching Jeffrey Smith's movie Genetic Roulette tipped me off that if I were to make some dietary changes, I might be able to solve some of the physical challenges I was experiencing. And now I'm just
eager
to learn
so
more.
You've been doing that, and people,
yeah,
you can do that and learn more by going to that link on Alana's website, igivetrees.com /GMOs. Now, we're coming down to the final minutes of our show.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much, Alana, for being my guest today and for all the work you're doing. It was just, you know, you're a person of great courage, and entrepreneurship and caring, and a great model for all of us. So thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Allison.
And our listeners.
Thank you, listeners.
I want to alert you to, you know, we've really been talking about the true sources of wealth today, because I think what's going on right now in our Congress and our society really is going to, it is forcing us to look bigger picture and really look deeper and question some things. I'm very excited about some upcoming shows that I have here on Connect the Dots, and I want to just mention them. In upcoming weeks, I'm going to be talking with an author called Saeed Dawalbani about his very exciting new book called Memeonomics, and it's about a spiral dynamics approach to different ways to use and run our economy and use and consider wealth and affluence and resources. And it's really quite a brilliant analysis of that, and he'll be on next week's show. We're also, in upcoming weeks, going to have Carolyn Baker, who will be talking with us about, you know, the emotional side of dealing with these, you know, very big challenges in our world and how that affects us each personally. So tune in every week to Connect the Dots, check our archives, like us on iTunes, and come back next week at Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern, for the next edition of the show. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and thank you so much for being with us today and Connect the Dots. Have a great week.